setting up the ITV remaining cases. Thank you.
All right, we will call the case of Yusuf versus the state. And counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your oral arguments. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral arguments. And you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Gina Schultz, Assistant State Public Defender, and I represent Yusuf Ahmed Yusuf, the appellant in this matter. There's one issue before this court today, and that's whether to remand back to the post-conviction court for consideration of Mr. Yusuf's petition on its merits. This court must do so because the post-conviction court abused its discretion by denying Mr. Yusuf's petition based on a clearly erroneous factual finding. Now, backing up just briefly to get a larger picture, because Mr. Yusuf filed his petition more than 2 years after his conviction became final, he does have to satisfy one of the exceptions to the statutory timeline in the post-conviction statute. And namely here, it's the interest of justice exception. And to establish that he satisfies this exception, he needs to show three things. First, that his petition is not frivolous. Second, that it should be considered in the interest of justice. And third, that his petition was brought within 2 years of when his claim arose. I'm going to start with the third factor because it's the only factor that was reached by the district court, and it's really the crux of our argument on appeal. So the post-conviction court in its order found that Yusuf was not clear about when he executed his FOIA request, nor when he received the requested information, whether it was or was not within the 2-year timeline for post-conviction relief.
Wouldn't that be an important fact to know?
Certainly.
Doesn't your client have the burden of in showing that when the claim arose?
Yes, Your Honor, and I guess I have a two-part answer to that. The first is that he did testify that he had executed his FOIA request within a year previous to the hearing, which would put him squarely within the 2 years after the claim arose. First, on direct examination in response to his counsel's question, he said, "I filed the FOIA request within the last year." And that's on page 6 of the evidentiary hearing transcript. And then again, on page 11, on cross-examination, Mr. Yusuf says, when the county attorney asked him the same question, said it was about a year ago that executed the FOIA request, and it took about 9 months to get that information, and then I filed this petition.
Can I ask you this? Is there any reason why he couldn't have filed a request earlier than when he did it?
He certainly could have, but that's not the standard here. Under Sanchez, it's an objective knew or should have known. It's not could have known.
Wouldn't this fall under should have known, though? Because if he suspected that January 1, which is often given to immigrants who don't know their birth date, was not his accurate birth date, couldn't he have at any time in the almost 10 years he had asked or requested that information to find out what the actual birth date was? It would have been an easy, at least an easy request to make.
Certainly he could have. And what Mr. Yusuf testified to is that he trusted his relatives, that the birth date that he's been registering for school under and doing everything, all his, you know, as far as he's known, that's been his birth date. He didn't question that. And I think the question of whether he should have questioned it, I guess I have a two-part answer to that. First is that it kind of depends on evidence outside the record. You know, was he at a school that had a lot of other refugee children there? Or did he personally know that that was not, that was a common birth date to be given to refugees? But second of all, even if he did have a reason to question that the birth date was not correct, it doesn't follow that he had any reason to suspect that he was almost 2 years younger than he originally thought. The difference between the two birth dates is 21 months. And as Your Honor saw in, the, in our brief, he turned 18 the day after he was charged with the underlying offense here. And so even if he should have known or could have known that that wasn't his birthday, it doesn't follow that he would have suspected that he was 17 at the time of this offense.
But are we here, I mean, are you asking us to find that the court's analysis of the facts here is clearly erroneous? Is that the standard we're looking at?
Yes. Yes, it is. And I believe that's supported by the record for the reasons articulated in our brief. And because when the post-conviction court, if the court would have said, you know, Mr. Yusuf testified to A, B, and C, but his testimony wasn't credible, that would be different. I wouldn't be able to make this argument here on appeal. But the post-conviction court's finding was about what he testified to. And it's just not correct. At the hearing, it is very clear that Mr. Yusuf said that he had executed the FOIA request within a year prior to the hearing, which puts him squarely within the 2 years. And my suspicion about what happened there is that Mr. Yusuf wasn't as clear in his supporting affidavit to his original petition. It did say, and that's what's quoted here in the district court order. And so my suspicion is that the district court was relying on recollection of the testimony and had the affidavit there right in front of him, and misremembered exactly what Mr. Yusuf had testified to, which when we're, you know, able to look at the transcript on appeal, is clear that he said it was within the last year.
Well, and I'm just looking at the judge's order. One thing that the judge found is that he had not carried his burden to overcome the two-year bar. So this is the judge weighing the evidence that was produced and determining that that was insufficient. And one of the points that the judge raises is that this is really not, that even if this was newly discovered evidence, there's nothing to show that he's innocent of the underlying offense.
And that is precisely why we didn't bring the newly discovered evidence exception on appeal, is that it doesn't show actual innocence. And that's why we're relying on the interest of justice.
All right.
Exception.
But he also found that he found the evidence for that one to be insufficient as well. And aren't you asking us to basically reweigh this evidence and come up with a different result?
No, not at all. What we're arguing is that the district court's finding there was based on the clearly erroneous factual finding, which is that Yusuf was not clear about whether he executed the FOIA request within the 2 years after the claim arose. That he didn't file the petition within 2 years of when the claim arose. And when we're able to look at the transcript, that's not right. He did testify that it was within, that he filed the petition within a year of executing his FOIA request. And that's really the fatal flaw of the post-conviction court's argument, and the crux of our argument here on appeal. To move on to the other two prongs of the interest of justice test, first of all, the first is that it's not frivolous. And here his argument is clearly not frivolous. If he was 17 at the time that he committed and was charged with these offenses, the district court did not have jurisdiction, and its conviction and sentence are void. And I think that's clearly laid out in the brief. The third, which I'd like to address a little bit more depth, is the interest. Is it should it be heard in the interest of justice? And there we have the Gassler factors to guide us. And the first, which is really connected with the not frivolous prong, is does the petition have substantive merit, and did the defendant deliberately and inexcusably fail to raise the evidence on direct appeal? There's no allegation here that he deliberately or inexcusably failed to raise it. He testified that he had no idea until the year before he filed this petition. The second factor is who's at fault? Is it the party alleging the error or the party defending against the error? And here, there's no allegation that the state is at fault, but neither is Mr. Youssef. He was a child when he came to the United States as a refugee. He was moved between, he was bounced from home to home for his whole childhood, never had any official paperwork, and was told by his family that this is his birthday. And he went with that. And for a 17-year-old, that makes sense. He had no reason to question what his family had told him. The third is whether there's some fundamental unfairness to the defendant that needs to be addressed. And this factor clearly weighs in favor of Mr. Youssef. He has had an adult conviction following him around for the over the last decade that might have been a juvenile adjudication. He served an adult sentence. He was sat in adult jail when he was detained. He has this, he, as we know from his probation violation hearing, he is now in immigration detention as a result of this adult conviction that may have been an adjudication. And even if not, he was convicted by a court that did not have jurisdiction. So there is a fundamental unfairness here. And finally, the fifth, which is related, is whether his petition should be heard because it's necessary to protect the integrity of legal proceedings. And this factor weighs very heavily in his favor because there's nothing more fundamental to judicial proceedings than jurisdiction. It gets at the very heart of the court's ability to adjudicate matters and make decisions. Without jurisdiction, the court that convicted him had no power to do so. And if that doesn't get at the heart of the integrity of judicial proceedings, well, I don't know what would.
Could I ask you about the, apparently the state makes arguments that there's an agent, Robert Petrick of Homeland Security, indicated that the Somali culture does not keep records of actual dates of birth. And actually said there was no way to check the records to get an actual date of birth. Was that submitted as part of the analysis here?
I guess I have a few responses to that. I don't believe the district court relied on that at all in its order, which is appropriate because it's entirely hearsay evidence. At the evidentiary hearing, the district court did give the state 2 weeks to contact Mr. Petrick or to submit any other kind of evidence, and the state declined to do so. And so it can't rely at this point on an affidavit filled with hearsay evidence that's not supported by anything in the record. And even if we did have some of the evidence alluded to in that affidavit, we have really conclusive evidence, which is his immigration documentation from the United States federal government, that I-94, which has his official birth date, his true birth date, as well as all the other immigration papers, that's definitive. That is the paperwork he would have gotten just as he entered the United States. I don't think there's anything in the record that comes close to the reliability of that kind of evidence that was introduced by Mr. Youssef.
Was there any objection to that evidence made at the time of its submission?
It was not actually entered as evidence. It was attached to the state's response to Mr. Youssef's original petition. So I don't believe it was entered into evidence at the evidentiary hearing.
I think they refer to it as document 15.
As document 15?
Right.
Before rebuttal, I'll quickly look at that transcript and refresh my recollection, and then I'll address it at that time.
Thank you.
I am starting to run out of time. Unless this court has any further questions for me, I'll sit down and reserve the rest for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
can you switch it? Oh, okay. Yes, if the respondent wants to start speaking, it will activate our video.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. Police the court, Gary Bjorklund, St. Louis County Attorney's Office, representing the respondent, State of Minnesota. The trial court level, there were some different issues that were raised, but it appears that the issue that's being appealed is pretty narrow, and that is whether or not the public interest exception to the two-year bar applies. And I think counsel is correct. I think that it's an objective standard, and the main issue is at what date does this claim arise? And I think the trial court found that Mr. Youssef did not meet that burden. As far as the dates, I mean, I think if you look at the transcript as a whole, it's pretty clear that Mr. Youssef did not know the exact date that he made the request for public information.
Well,
however,
what about the argument of counsel, though, that he said he did it, and I think I actually wrote it down and quoted her, that he said he did it about a year ago.
Judge, I agree. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I do agree 100% with that. I think it's clear to read the whole transcript. If the request and the information he got from Homeland Security was obtained within that two-year period. But the question still arises, at what date does the claim arise? And it's no or should have known. Okay. It's clear that he didn't know until he got the information back. But I think the main issue is, at what point did the claim rise? At what point should he have known? He was just turned 18 at the time that the complaint was filed. He was 18 for several years before this post-conviction was asked for. At some point, just the fact that your date of birth is given as January 1st of a certain year, I think it's 1986, if I remember right. You know, that alone is suspicious. And at some point, when you're in the, immigrant
counsel,
from a
counsel,
country,
why would, what would raise somebody's suspicion that their birth date is January 1st when his testimony, his affidavit says he relied on his family? And not only did he rely on that, but according to the FOIA request information, his birth date, it's a two-year age difference. It's not just 1 year. I mean, 2 years is pretty significant, isn't it?
21 months is very significant, Your Honor. It's tough to answer that question. He lived in the Somalian community, I believe. He did testify that he was not familiar with the culture from his home country. But he did came here with no documentation. I think his mother was deceased. His father sponsored him. He had since lost contact with his sponsor and gone from relative to relative. He never had any actual documentation to support what his date of birth was.
But
and
he was told by his family that was his birth date. So, I mean, are you saying that a child should question the birth date that they're told of? That seems a little odd.
No, I don't think a child should, but I think at some point Mr. Youssef became 18 and then beyond that for the next 10 years. And at some point maybe he should start to realize or question whether or not the January 1st was an appropriate and actual date.
Okay, but it's an objective standard. So what date is the state arguing that he should have known that his birth date was not correct?
I don't know if I can give you an exact date. It's like, it's a continuum. I believe at some point before the two-year period. If I'm wrong on that, I think the remedy is pretty clear. He should have a hearing on the merits.
Okay,
I think
if you can't give some type of date or some reason why he should have known, I'm struggling with how we would affirm then.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess my response is, first, the burden is upon Mr. Youssef. It's not on me to give a date that he should have known. The second thing is that the trial court found he did not meet that burden. Is that an abuse of discretion?
Right, but what basis is the? I mean, I had a hard time finding where the post-conviction court's rationale as to why that was irrational, or why that did not meet that objective standard.
You know, the trial court did not address that. I mean, it did address. I agree 100%. The case was briefed at a couple different theories by Mr. Youssef at the trial court level, and the interest of justice was mentioned in the first response, but was never briefed or argued throughout Mr. Youssef's attorney's arguments or briefs that he filed. I think I filed one, and my response was that it wasn't timely, but if it was, I asked for an evidentiary hearing. And so, yeah, that particular issue, it was not addressed in detail or with specific findings by the trial court.
Well, is there anything in the record, though, that indicates, I mean, because the inference has been made that because of the date, and I assume that the inference is that because a lot of immigrants use that January 1st date when they don't know the real date, that should have given him some reason to doubt the validity of the date he was given as his birth date. Is there anything in the record that you can point to that would support that was the situation with refugees and the use of the January 1 as the date?
Other than my affidavit from my conversation with Agent Petrick from Homeland Security, there's nothing else in the record.
Apparently this is hearsay. You didn't get an affidavit from Mr. Petrick, right?
Your Honor, I need to get a response back in very quickly to the initial petition. It is difficult to get documents from Homeland Security or testimony because you got to go through an attorney in Washington, D.C. to get it approved. So I went my affidavit route just to get something back in. It's not the preferred route. I wish I could have gone something different. And, you know, the record's not good. I mean, we showed up for the hearing. It was scheduled as a probation hearing, and I talked to Mr. Tyler. Neither him or I knew the court was going to call this case, and neither side was ready to put on testimony. And as a result, we both got a little bit surprised by that, but he did elect to put his client on the stand. So the record could have been better. The judge never ruled or said we're going to have an evidentiary hearing that day or made an initial decision whether Mr. Youssef was entitled to an evidentiary hearing.
Okay, fair enough. We certainly understand the constraints on the party's counsel. So basically it really comes down to whether or not the district court clearly erred by finding that he did not meet the two-year deadline, and based on, even though he said that he had filed his FOIA request within the past year, then is that really kind of the heart of the issue here? Then
I'm not sure I follow that 100%. I'm sorry. The heart of the issue is when the date of the claim arose. If the date of the claim arose when he got the information from Homeland Security, he's clearly inside the 2 years. If the date of the claim would have arisen sooner because he should have known, then it's outside the 2 years is the state's position. I can't give you an exact date on that. I know counsel for the Mr. Youssef talked about me not asking for an evidentiary hearing. My first response, I wanted a ruling without an evidentiary hearing because I didn't think that Mr. Youssef had made the burden. I didn't ask for an evidentiary hearing because I was still hoping the court would decline the petition without an evidentiary hearing. I don't, my opinion was we didn't have an evidentiary hearing that date. And maybe this is a case that, given the record, we, you know, in hindsight, I guess I wish I would have asked for an evidentiary hearing because we could have got the people there needed, made the record, and then the court probably could have had the record needed to make the decision. In hindsight, I probably should have asked for the evidentiary hearing. I didn't do that because I felt the burden was upon Mr. Youssef, and I did not feel that he had established that he was entitled to one. Maybe I was wrong on that.
Well, I'm just looking at the Sanchez case, and the Sanchez case seems to be pretty clear that that it's not the merits that are going to be tried in determining whether, in the interest of justice, that you know that they can file the claim past the 2-year statute of limitations. It's whether there was something prohibiting them from discovering or from the issue arising, or whether they knew or should have known. And I understand that your argument is that he should have known. And am I correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right. Well, I have another question. This is a little bit different than Sanchez and a lot of the cases in that we're actually talking about a claim being made that the court that did this conviction, that handled the conviction and sentence, did not have subject matter jurisdiction. And how do I read Sanchez in light of the principle that if it's a jurisdictional defect, that can be raised at any time? Is that something that can be that falls under Sanchez? Are we in a different area of the law?
I don't know if we're in a different area or not. In Vang, that issue was declined to be decided by the Supreme Court, and they used their inherent power to vacate the conviction and remand it. But that issue was also the 2-year statute of was before the court in Vang, and they declined to do it. And I think that's an open question. I'm not aware of any law that says the 2-year doesn't apply under these circumstances, but I understand the court's concern that you do have, if you have a person who is a juvenile, you do have the concern that you have a court without jurisdiction. I think that's an open question. I think that's, if the case gets remanded, I suspect that that's something that's going to have to be decided should the court then decide that Mr. Youssef was in fact a juvenile when the complaint was filed. But I understand the court's concern. I don't have an answer to that, and I don't think there's any clear law that says whether or not there is a definite answer to that at this point.
Well, and I think the basis for the decision in Vang was whether the court, in the exercise of its inherent authority, could go ahead and consider the issue, notwithstanding it was post the 2-year statutory bar, and the court yep. held they could in that situation. Is this case distinguishable from Vang?
Well, I think the facts are so egregious in Vang as to why the 2-year lapse before. The fact that you got a court that may or may not have had jurisdiction is troublesome. But the facts in Vang are so egregious, or the facts in this case, I think even though they're egregious, they're bad, but I don't think you've got the level of neglect that there was in Vang. I don't know if any party here really, really did anything wrong. And in this case, it just happened that information may or may not have been incorrect, and people relied on it.
Well, so I guess you're not sure how if this situation, whether when it involves jurisdiction, whether that falls under the Sanchez requirements.
Well, you know,
post-2-year hearing.
I'm not sure. I mean, there could be circumstances where, you know, a defendant could knowingly know he has this issue, wait till beyond the period, and say the court doesn't have jurisdiction. In Vang, that wasn't an issue because there's no statute of limitations. This case does have a statute of limitations, so and that could play a big role whether or not anything could be pursued if the case is remanded and the conviction vacated. I think I'm out of time.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to start briefly by addressing Judge Hooten's question about Mr. Bjorklund's affidavit. And I did go back and read the transcript of the evidentiary hearing, and it was not entered as an exhibit at that time. It does have a document index number, and that was assigned at the time that it was submitted with Mr. Bjorklund's response to Mr. Yusuf's petition.
Well, can I ask you, because I'm a little confused. Was there an evidentiary hearing or was there not? And
I mean,
how did this all come up? Because it wasn't it a probation hearing originally?
It was, Your Honor. And I was just about to address that.
Okay. And I just want to make sure I understand the facts. Was your client, apparently a warrant was issued for his arrest earlier. Had your client been basically on the lam for a number of years before he was picked up?
So what Mr. Yusuf testified to is that he there was a bench warrant, but he wasn't familiar with it, and apparently there had been some sort of discrepancy, and so that it hadn't actually been activated, so he'd never been picked up. His testimony is that he didn't know about it until he started working with his immigration attorney and trying to address his obstacles to naturalizing.
All right. And so wasn't it like a decade later, and then he's picked up?
Yep.
On the warrant, and then this was a probation and violation hearing.
And he wasn't actually picked up on the warrant. He turned himself in with this petition for post-conviction relief.
Okay. All right. So it was set up as I assume for both hearings?
Yes. So that it is a very unusual procedural posture, which I do think put both parties kind of at a disadvantage. So it was scheduled as a contested probation revocation hearing, or violation hearing, rather. But the district court allowed Mr. Yusuf to present testimony for the record on his PC petition. And he was able to do that. But I do think, you know, for example, Mr. Yusuf, the county attorney asked Mr. Yusuf if he had a copy of his actual FOIA request. And he said, yes, it's with my immigration attorney. And it's clearly not in the record, but I assume if he knew this were scheduled as an evidentiary hearing, he would have come prepared with that paperwork.
So you agree that neither party knew that this was going to be an evidentiary hearing? Is that correct?
That's certainly what the record looks like. But then the post-conviction court did allow the state an additional 2 weeks to let the court know if they needed to either submit evidence or just let them know if we needed to schedule an additional evidentiary hearing. The state declined to do so.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Or yes, Your Honor. So the next issue I wanted to address, Mr. Bjorklund brought up the concern that a defendant might know that there's a jurisdictional defect and then wait, you know, 10 years down the line to raise it. And I don't understand that concern, particularly in Mr. Yusuf's case. He's only at a disadvantage for having discovered this so late. As I summarized earlier, you know, he served an adult sentence. He was discharged from adult probation, sat in adult jail. And is at this point now in immigration detention in removal proceedings. He had no incentive to wait it's only, and that goes to the fundamental unfairness factor in the Gassler factors, that this is just something that he shouldn't have had to live with. And he has. So at this point, and I also want to make the point that the Gassler factors, you know, Gassler itself says this is not a rigid test and it's adaptable to unique circumstances. And Mr. Youssef's is clearly a unique circumstance where we discovered this jurisdictional defect a decade down the road. And it wasn't really anyone's fault, but he shouldn't have to live with the weight and the consequences of that mistake. Okay.
And I just want to make sure I understand your arguments before us today. I mean,
absolutely.
Are you arguing that the record is insufficient, that your client knew or should have known that this birth date was incorrect? So therefore,
I'm arguing
therefore
that
he could not have brought it sooner than what he did. Is that your argument?
Yes.
Is that the sole
yes.
issue before us?
That's the sole issue before this court. I mean, the district court didn't reach either the issue of whether the petition was frivolous or whether it should be heard in the interest of justice. And so the only thing that we have a district court decision on is whether it was raised within 2 years of the claim having arose. And we're arguing here that the district court made its decision based on a clearly erroneous factual finding.
And your clearly erroneous factual finding is that when he testified that he just learned about it within the past year from filing the FOIA request, that's well within the two-year time frame. So there's no bar there. So the district court abused its discretion by having that clearly erroneous finding. Is that your position?
That is exactly our argument.
Okay.
All right.
So unless this court has other questions, we're asking this court to reverse and remand for consideration of the merits of the petition.
All right. Very good. We will take the matter under advisement. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
To set it up now, or?
I think that it should be set up with the other attorneys. It seems like they might be in the same courthouse because they are also.
Oh, okay. So. I don't think we finished early. So.
I can check with Sue to double check that.
In fact, we're actually running late. A little bit.